Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I am your host, Kim Kessler, with the Resnick Program for Food Law and Policy at UCLA School of Law, and we are broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn on Heritage Radio Network. And I want to also introduce my assistant producer, Talia Ralph. She's joining me today in the studio to co-host. Hi, Talia.
Hi, Kim. Thanks for having me.
Today, we are going to delve into two groundbreaking civil rights lawsuits against the United States Department of Agriculture, with one of the lead plaintiff attorneys from the cases, Anurag Varma, of the firm Akin Gump, Strauss, and Hauer and Feld. In the case, Pigford v. Glickman, in one of the lead cases, Pigford v. Glickman, African-American farmers claimed that the USDA had systemically discriminated against them on the basis of race, wrongfully denying them of farm loans and assistance. There was also a subsequent case relating to alleged USDA discrimination against Native American farmers. We're going to be talking about both of those cases with our guest, and I want to welcome Anurag Varma, who I believe is calling in from Washington, D.C. today. Hi, Anurag.
Hi, Kim.
He came and presented at UCLA Law School earlier this year about his work on these cases as plaintiff's attorney to an absolutely rapt audience. And Anurag, I'm really glad that you can join for the show today.
It's great to be on the line with you.
So as I have just described, the Pigford case was ultimately a case of real historical significance, resulting not only in more than a $1 billion settlement, but also changes to practices at the USDA. But you were involved from the case from the very beginning, and that wasn't necessarily how you knew it would all end up when you started out then. Can you tell us the story about the origins of the case and how you got involved?
Sure. The case, I'll give you a little background. It's a discrimination case, and it comes from a long history, the history being USDA has federal farm loan programs. These programs are implemented in a very decentralized way. So at one time, USDA had about 2,700 offices around the country, county offices. And so when you'd read in the paper that, you know, X billion dollars, you know, has been, you know, given to USDA by Congress for their loan programs, well, those billions of dollars would go, be filtered down, and each county office would get millions of dollars to then, you know, give out in loans. And
maybe it would actually even be helpful to talk about how important loans are in the farming business and why that's such a big part of USDA's programming.
Absolutely. The loans are what allow a farmer to have money on the front end. So, you know, typically in the South, for example, you know, it all varies upon temperature and weather and such. But let's just take, a cotton farm in the South. You know, in the early in the year, what you would need is you need to prepare the land, till it, get fertilizer, put some chemicals down, I mean, prepare the land, then you'd seed it, and then, you know, you'd have to kind of take care of the crops. You actually wouldn't get paid until the end of the crop year. So the front-end money, unless you're, you know, individually wealthy, the money on the front end, you know, allows you to get to the point where you harvest your crops and then can go to market, and then you can pay back your loans and, you know, keep the rest as profit, put it back into your farm, put it into your family. But it's very important, these loan programs. And in theory, the USDA's loan programs, you know, were a great thing and were a great asset. The USDA served as what they call a lender of last resort. So if you couldn't get a loan from a bank because you were too small, you know, or you didn't have enough crop history or you had a couple bad years, USDA was to be that lender, that backstop, to make sure that you had enough land to go, enough money to go get seed and fertilizer, et cetera. So these programs theoretically should have been open to everybody. However, if you had a local a county official, you know, a loan supervisor, which is actually a federal employee who worked in the rural local county office, that person, when they got their millions of dollars to give out, they'd first give it to friends and family, people they knew, people they wanted to help. If you weren't in that circle, if you weren't in that club, you were not going to get that money. The history of this fact pattern I just described to you goes back decades. Our little law firm, one of the partners there, was actually an expert on helping farmers get loans and get other subsidies. But most of who he and we dealt with were not minority farmers. They were the big, the big white farmers with, you know, thousands of acres of land. And those were the favored people in these offices. One day in 97, three African-American farmers came into our office and told us this story and asked us to represent them.
Their own story was what you're talking about, like essentially not an equal ability to get access to the loans?
Yes. So they told us that story with some digging and with their help. You know, we found a couple things that were happening right then and there in 1997. One is the U.S. Department of Agriculture under Dan Glickman, Secretary Glickman, did a self-study called the Civil Rights Action Team Report. And that self-study revealed all of these fact patterns and the differential treatment between minority farmers and white farmers. At the same time, what even made things worse is there was another study done the following year, 1998. It was a series of studies from the USDA Office of Inspector General, which found that the Civil Rights Office of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the office that was supposed to investigate any allegations or complaints of discrimination, that office had been defunded 15 years earlier, 1983. So essentially, the local county official who was, you know, being blatant and racist and giving out loans actually didn't have any checks and balances because there was no oversight, no civil rights office that was functioning or to check them. And that's essentially the heart of the case, not only the one we did that you mentioned, Pigford, with the African-American farmers, but 2 years later we filed another case called Keepsiegel on behalf of American Indian farmers. The fact pattern being absolutely identical, the only difference being that there are different parts of the country were involved.
And so this is the background that ultimately gave USDA the nickname The Last Plantation.
That's right, because there's plantation owners and the workers in the fields. And this is the kind of thing that if you got to go into the house, you were special, you were an invited guest, you were family, meaning those people who got the loans, and everyone else was out in the fields.
And Anurag, can you tell us, I mean, because you've traveled all throughout the South, right, and you spoke to all of these, or a lot of these farmers that experienced this discrimination, what kind of stories were you hearing from them?
Unfortunately, a lot of repeating fact patterns. I went to the office, I asked about a loan, they told me they didn't have any money and told me to go away. I went to the office, tried to get a loan, they handed me a 40-page application, told me to go away and fill it out, you know, and then I looked across the office and they were helping three white farmers fill out the paperwork, but they wouldn't help me. We had a documented case that actually 60 Minutes reported out back in 98, and that was how a county official had something called Black Tuesdays, where he would only see African-American customers On Tuesdays. The list goes on and on, and frankly, it gets even more complicated and sophisticated, where they would give a loan, but nowhere near enough to be successful. And then they, you know, and any farmer will tell you that they work with their bank year after year after year. They do business plans. None of this help was given to the minority farmers. This kind of intimate borrower-lender relationship, which is present throughout rural America, but in USDA's case, it was disparate between what minorities and white farmers how they were treated. Mm-hmm.
So take us back to you're a junior attorney in Washington D.C. in 1997, and you're working at a firm that typically works with successful farmers in getting more money from the USDA, and you have these farmers come in, and what was the initial reaction of you and your colleagues?
It was stunning. Alex Pyres, who was the partner back then in 97, my boss, who started the case, and I started it with him, his immediate reaction was, well, everybody knows you can't trust USDA. So it was, although the fact pattern of the racism was stunning, I think what Alex, who had a history of suing the government to try to get, you know, fair treatment, fair subsidies and loans for his very rich white farmers, our immediate reaction wasn't necessarily shock by the race part, but it was shock at how blatantly bad USDA was behaving, just generally speaking, and that there needed to be some justice, because it is an agency that was very poorly run at that time.
And so how did you set about starting the case?
Well, we decided to go to the South and get some plaintiffs. You know, it was a really unique situation, because normally in a class action you get your lead plaintiffs, you file, you take your case to a certain point, and then once the judge certifies your class, then you are allowed to then advertise across the country, and then go get more farmers. We knew that the government and the best lawyers in our country work for the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice was representing USDA. We knew they were going to come at us. We were a little firm. We knew we had to make a splash right away, and we thought the way we'd do it is go out and get as many plaintiffs as we can on the front end. So we started traveling around the South and collecting names and having meetings, and three grew to seven, grew to 11, grew to 26, and by the time we were done, we had over 400 farmers signed up, and that really made a splash.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Talia.
I'm wondering, aside from the sheer number of plaintiffs you had, and also maybe the consistency of their stories, what you think helped you win? What were some of the big flashpoints of your case that you think pushed it to be successful?
We had some great ones. We one of the things that I'm not sure we fully expected was it started becoming a bit of a movement in the African American farming community, and the farmers, every time we had a hearing, would get in their cars and trucks and drive up to Washington D.C. And it was as amazing as one of the guys would start in southern Georgia, pick someone up, you know, in northern Georgia, and then pick someone else up in South Carolina, and pick someone else up in North Carolina. And we would have hundreds of farmers show up at our hearings. And for a federal court, I mean, when you watch movies, you see old courtrooms are packed. That doesn't really happen in real life. and so the fact that it was happening really sent a signal to the judge. It sent a signal to the media. And this kind of movement began, and it really turned the dynamics of a bunch of little law firms against big bad, you know, Department of Justice, you know, David and Goliath. It really kind of started leveling the playing field a little bit because we kind of had the white hat on and we had this movement behind us. It was all started by the farmers.
So, Anurag, I want to take a short break and then come back and hear a little bit more about that courtroom drama and the role of the media in all this. You are listening to A Harbor, A Sailor by The Sparrows. This is Eating Matters on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
For faithful fair weather, come carry us homeward. For nights in the taverns and days in the glen. A salt breeze cuts through me, she whistles my sordid companion. She whispers, come carry me home.
The following program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
And we're back on Eating Matters. I'm Kim Kessler. We're talking today about the discrimination case against the USDA, Pigford v. Glickman, and its companion case, or somewhat of a companion case, Keep Siegel versus USDA. I'm also joined by Talia Rolfe, who is guest co-hosting with me today. And we have Anurag Varma, one of the plaintiff's counsel from the case, on the line with us. So Anurag, before the break, we were just starting to hear a little bit about that David and Goliath narrative that the case began to fit into when you began to have court hearings. And I wanted to ask you more about that context, because the case did have a real political resonance, and that was part of what you were able to use to advance your goals as plaintiff's counsel. So can you share with us, you know, what were some of those moments in the courtroom that caught the media's attention, and what were the dynamics at play with the case being situated in D.C.?
Sure. I think what caught everyone's attention wasn't necessarily the courtroom drama, but more the story. And the Wall Street Journal did a front page story on our case. So did the Washington Post and the New York Times. And before you knew it, 60 Minutes loved the story, and they designated about half an hour of their show just towards a piece about this case. And there was a stretch of time that's particularly prominent in my mind, around September of 1998, and I might be a little bit off on the dates, but the U.S. Congress passed special legislation inserted in the, I believe, in the Appropriations Bill. They inserted special language just to waive the statute of limitations in the Pigford case and then all future cases like it. And just for anyone who doesn't know what the statute of limitations is, it's basically a time bar. So, you know, if you get into a car accident and you want to sue somebody, you have to do it within, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 6 years, whatever the law says. But there's always a time limit. So we brought this case in 1997, and so theoretically there was a limit of 2 years, 3 years, 6 years, whatever the law said. So we couldn't go back all the way back to when they dismantled the Office of Civil Rights. Well, Congress stepped in, and Democrats and Republicans together, Newt Gingrich and the Congressional Black Caucus, got together and passed a waiver of the statute of limitations. It's in the U.S. law, That waiver then led us go all the way back to 81. That caught the media's attention. This is in September. In October, September also was the 60 Minutes airing of the 60 Minutes story, and we had gotten word that our federal judge and his staff had gathered around a TV to watch it together, the 60 Minutes story. We had a hearing. I believe the date was around October 13th. On October 9th, the judge certified us as a class action, which is a very big moment in any class action case. It basically gives the blessing to plaintiffs that, yes, you are a united whole, and you're allowed to take this case nationally. 3 days later, or 4 days later, on the 13th, we were supposed to have a hearing in Washington. So on the 12th, about 200-300 African-American farmers came up to Washington, D.C. and marched. And then the next day we had our hearing, and there were so many people at the hearing, they had to move it into a special courtroom to accommodate all of us. And I think after all of that, maybe it was a week later, October 20th, we got a call from a political appointee in the U.S. Department of Justice saying, okay, we're ready to talk settlement. That's just an illustration of how a movement kind of created its own moments. And it was a very exciting time.
We definitely want to get to Keep Siegel and other similar cases, but as you're talking about sort of this movement and crowd, I can't help but thinking about the protests that we have been seeing recently. I'm wondering if you see another lawsuit on the horizon that is going to be similar. I mean, we have that same sort of groundswell, and it's interesting to think of Pigford as happening so long ago, and yet we still have, you know, not in agriculture necessarily, but a lot of this movement and this energy around African-American rights in America. I'm wondering sort of if it's resonated with you and how you see it playing out today or echoing today.
Right, and it's interesting that you say that. So the groundswell in our case came after after we had filed the case, I think that we were able to kind of channel or direct a lot of the energy, and that's because we had a lawsuit. It focused on loans. It had a defendant. It had a cause of action, there was an ability to kind of laser-like focus. I think that one of the things that's really hard, not just because of the state of the law of class action law, which is the courts are leaning more and more against class actions, the question is can a clever lawyer or group of lawyers find a way to take a wrong and fit it into what we call a cause of action, basically a way, an avenue to get relief through the courts?
A way to sue.
I'm going to jump to the Keep Siegel case. You know, the vehicle and the fact pattern being what it was. It had a thread that went through different communities, and that thread being that if you did not look like the person who was giving out the loans, or if you didn't grow up with him and hang out with him and so on and so forth, then you were not going to get a loan. And that person could continue to get away with such conduct because at a national level there was no checks and balances that are actually required by U.S. law. It's that thread which allowed us then to file the American Indian case called Keep Siegel. Unfortunately, by the time we filed Keep Siegel, the government had really dug its heels in and had decided we're not settling. We're not settling no time.
So what was it? How did that case develop then?
Sure, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask you again then. How did that case develop, and what were the differences? You described, you know, really quite... particularly for a massive class action, quite a quick resolution relatively coming about, or at least moving towards settlement in the Pickford case, and how did things move with KeepSigil? I know it was a different story.
Yeah, it was a different slog. The government, the Department of Justice, was basically very driven to not repeat, which turned out to be a very big loss in the African American farmers case for lawyers, you know, and a lot of courtroom lawyers, you know, think about things in terms of wins and losses. Even though it was a settlement, you know, it was essentially a loss, and they were really looking at not having that repeat. The administration was also changing at the time, so there was just a different view towards discrimination cases. Again, this is 99-2000. And the other thing is that it was a lot more difficult to organize east to west. See, when you have a lot of African American farmers coming, from the south. I mean, in many ways, it's essentially one highway, I-95, you know, and maybe another highway. You know, when you're going east to west, you know, North Dakota is a long ways away. Mm-hmm. Arizona, New Mexico are a long ways away from Washington D.C. You can't just drive and, you know, pay for two tanks of gas and drive back.
Right.
I mean, you actually have to buy a $1,000 plane ticket. I mean, so it was very different. The media paid less attention because the courtroom momentum wasn't there because DOJ was fighting so hard. That case was a lot more difficult and probably in some ways a lot more normal.
the Pickford
case, settling, going from start to finish in 18 months is something else.
So, but ultimately, the KeepSigil case also resulted in a very significant settlement amount. And I did want to ask you, I know that there has been some controversy regarding the settlements and the size of the settlements, and some have criticized the government's broad approach to creating these large settlement funds and not requiring significant documentation to prove claims, and that there's been questions about whether or not the settlements are magnets for fraud. And I wanted to get your perspective on that. What's your view on the size of the settlements, and do you think that the cases were resolved correctly?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Now, our regular response, and Alex Pyres and myself and many others, our response generally is that these settlements happen all the time and require a lot less information than our cases did. Our cases required someone to fill out six pages of paper, sign an affidavit. I mean, a whole lot was required of each person compared to the average check-the-box class action settlement. You know, aluminum siding, cases where you just check the box, yes, I bought aluminum siding in, 1991, check, and then you get a check in the mail. But secondly is, even the folks alleging, fraud, I'm not sure they'd be alleging fraud if they were talking not about minority farmers. I mean, these class actions settle for hundreds of millions of dollars all the time, billions of dollars in some cases, and the government, would walk into settlement discussions saying, well, we need to stop fraud, and we would turn to them and said, actually, what you need to be focused on is compensating victims of racial discrimination. So the focus on fraud, we've always rejected it, I think these were great settlements, and frankly, I wish the folks didn't have to fill out so much paperwork, but in a settlement, you don't win on every point.
Mm-hmm. And Anurag, you actually testified before the UN High Commission on Minorities about this topic. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit what that commission focused on and sort of how Pickford and KeepSigil do relate to, countries outside the U.S. and on a global scale when we're talking about discrimination.
Sure. Yeah, and it was very interesting. It was the United Nations Human Rights Commission in Geneva, and they were focused on the relationship between disproportionate land ownership and minority populations as a global phenomenon. Mm. And essentially, when you talk about somebody not being given the opportunity to get the loans necessary to grow their farming operation and then buy more land and et cetera, I mean, that's they're all interlinked in that way, and the UN was focused on that. It was very interesting. In a way, I felt both very grateful and sad. I met folks such as, a nomadic farming tribe from rural Ethiopia that said, "Your story is exactly like our story with government programs," and they were a minority population in that country. They said, "Well, how can we do this?" And the answer is, in a lot of countries, they don't have our court system and our avenues for seeking relief. And so it made me very appreciative of kind of the fact that in America we have this fancy car called our court system, and not every country has that same fancy car. So it was very, very eye-opening, but it really did link the work that we were doing with what people all over the what minority populations face all over the world.
So Anurag, I want to, before we wrap up, ask you about your personal experience working on this case, because it's somewhat of an unusual career story to have these farmers walk into your office when I know that you were, I think, just relatively quickly out of law school at that point. But it shows how taking an opportunity can really lead you to unexpected places. And so for our listeners, what advice would you give to either young lawyers or other professionals who do want to use their skills in some way to working towards a more just society?
Yeah, and it's I hate to copy or violate law by copying Nike, but you just do it, and that's you can't always overthink and chart everything out and be real type A about everything, and you can't be lazy either. You gotta you just gotta take the opportunity, seize the day, and just do it. And it was it's been the greatest honor in my life to work on both of these cases. And and you're right, I was 24 years old, now I'm not. and as my boss back then said, this case is going to spoil you for the rest of your life because you're doing it first. Absolutely. But it all happened because we didn't really think a lot about consequences. We didn't, get scared or get excited. We just did it. So I think that's the real message, and I'm just very proud to be a part of it.
It's a very good advice, especially for young lawyers. Don't be type A and overthink. Now we know how important that is.
it's the impossible, but yeah.
All right. Well, so Anurag, I want to thank you so much for being on today and telling us about the cases and your experience with them. We're glad that you could join, and that's going to bring us to the end of this episode of Eating Matters. I want to also thank Talia for joining me here in the studio today, and to Tim Archer for our show music and all of our sponsors. This show will be available at Heritage Radio Network as well as a podcast at iTunes and Stitcher. I'm Kim Kessler, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.